Welcome to the Wheeler Centre. I'm George Miglogenis, and I'm about to introduce you to Annabel Crabb, author, journalist, and television series maker extraordinaire. But the housekeeping first, phone's on silent. Do we want flashes?
The flashes can leave too, yes.
Okay, no flash photography. I suppose you all want to tweet. You can tweet, but don't tweet any abuse in our name. I don't know what the hashtag is for this one tonight. But we're here tonight to discuss Annabel's book, The Wife Trout, which is not about climate change. It's actually about a topic that everyone has a theory on. It's work-life balance. But before we begin, we're going to do a reading together. So, actually, I should give a very quick introduction. What part of the introduction do you need?
Hi, I'm Annabel.
ABC, formerly Fairfax and News Limited, and probably premier journalist across all platforms in Australia today, if I can say that. I think I can say that. Now, we are going to read you a little debate. I'll get Annabel to introduce it, because you've dug this one out. This is one of the possibly the funniest debates in Parliament I've read in the last little while.
This is ancient Hansard, so really it hasn't been read since Kevin Rudd was a schoolboy subscribing to Hansard. One of the things that I point out or remark upon in the book is the fact that it wasn't until 1966 that the Commonwealth of Australia stopped obliging female federal public servants from resigning when they got married. It was obligatory, and in fact, women in the federal public service used to go to all sorts of lengths to avoid getting the sack, secretly getting married, secretly living in sin. There's this great woman at the CSIRO who had four children, each one in her annual leave. It was absolutely brilliant, precise work there. We had it much longer than comparable countries, the wife bar, it's called, the marriage bar, I should say. And I went back to the Hansard from 1922, when the marriage bar was cemented into legislation. It was already being practiced, but the House of Representatives had cause to consider whether the marriage bar was worth keeping. And the parties to this debate are a guy called Austin Chapman, who was a nationalist from Eden Monaro. And as you know, the members for Eden Monaro are always a bit bonkers. He was already famous for having designed a lightweight wheat bag called the Chapman sack. And he, in this debate, is questioning the Attorney General and a couple of other MPs who are supporters of the marriage bar. So George is going to play the part of heroic Mr. Chapman, and I will be most of the villains.
Most of the villains. There is another one who bops up as well. But Mr. Chapman asked, very simply, why should a female officer be deemed to have retired from the service upon her marriage?
Because it would be difficult for a woman to attend to her household as well as her departmental duties. There would be a conflict of duty. This clause is in accordance with the practice of all public servants.
Now, Mr. Francis bobs up, but supposing a woman has an invalid husband?
Well, the board may take into account special circumstances. A married woman may, in certain circumstances, be given temporary employment in the service. And as a matter of fact, many widows are in many cases temporarily employed as office cleaners. In this clause, however, we're dealing with the permanent service, entrance to which is to be secured only by passing the prescribed examination. I do not think we could adopt any other course than that for which the clause provides.
Under this clause, a female officer on her marriage will be discharged from the service.
Well, that has always been the law.
Is there any reason we should perpetuate such an anomaly? Why should we not depart for some of these musty old precedents? Sorry, why should we not depart from some of these musty old precedents? I know of a lady in the public service who wants to get married, but is told that if she does so, she must retire. She has a splendid record, has done good work in the service, and does not wish to leave it. It is not fair that she should be called upon her marriage to retire.
Is it not in the public interest that a female officer on her marriage should retire from the service?
Very simply, he says, why? And they go on for another couple of pages.
because if she remained in the service, she would have to neglect her home duties.
And it's very important to remember that in those days, of course, we were a medium-sized mediocrity. Australia had long since been that marvellous country of the 19th century that was the richest country on earth at the time. Unemployment was about 5, 6%, and there was a concern that women were going to knock men out of work.
That's right. And in fact, some of the greatest supporters of the marriage bar were the unions, because there was a wholesale fear with unemployment on the rise that women were taking the jobs that were intended for men. The idea was that once you were married, you had a source of support, and so it would be greedy to continue to claim another.
But you also had a job, right, when you were married? It's called home duties.
That's right, yeah. Very important. And you were neglecting your husband and undermining the husbands of others by keeping on at work. I talked to this great woman called Merle Thornton. Now, she was a woman who illicitly kept a job, actually as a secretary to the controller of the ABC, until she got so pregnant that she couldn't hide her coupled state anymore. She went on to be something of a hellraiser, actually. She moved to Queensland and chained herself to a bar in order to protest the ban on women drinking in pubs. She and another friend, who's also quite a looker, chained themselves to a bar in Queensland and got all sorts of media. And later on, she was one of the campaigners against the marriage bar. She collected all these stories from women who had run foul of this restriction, and eventually was part of the move to abolish it. She also went on to write some plays, some of which were performed by her famous daughter Sigrid Thornton. How about that? Yeah, she is great, Merle.
Now, Annabelle, give me a quick run through. So as you dig through the past, you find a lot of these patterns repeating. But just give me a run through of why you wrote this book at this time. How long was it sitting in your gut or on the back of your head? And then how long did it take to spit out?
Well, about a year ago, I wrote a really snippy column in the Sunday Age, which was about the argument that we had just over a year ago about why there aren't more women in federal parliament. I mean, that argument had been sort of in hiatus for a while we had a woman governor general and a woman prime minister and quite a few women in cabinet. And then just over a year ago, when Tony Abbott swore in a new cabinet, only one woman, we kind of fell back into this head-scratching about why there aren't more women in federal politics. And I wrote a slightly snippy column just saying, listen, you know, there would be more women in federal politics if they got the same sort of spouses that the men have in federal politics, right? I mean, if you have a job where you've got to be away from your home 20 weeks a year and you also want to have a family or a life at the same time, you really have to have a rather special model spouse to make that happen. And to date, you know, since Federation, most of those special model spouses have been lady spouses. So I thought if there was a quota for sort of male wives, then, you know, maybe we might be getting somewhere in terms of representation of women in federal politics. And anyway, I went off to give a speech somewhere in Queensland the day that it went to print. And I was, by some sort of administrative error, I was having breakfast by myself, attended by tiny people. And knowing the joy and peace that can only come to a woman who has spent a night in a hotel room alone. Oh, God. Yes, and having breakfast alone and showering alone. Good God. Anyway, so I was getting all of these emails and kind of reactions from this column, mainly from women who were writing to me and saying, it's not just politics, you know. The pain of not having a wife when your male competitors have wives is a universal one, or concentrated in all sorts of different professions. And so I started thinking, maybe there's a book in this, in the incredibly rash way that only slightly over-rewarded columnists have when they've written a column that people actually read and they think, God, I'm onto something, this is huge. But I did, you know, so I did think maybe there was a book in it. And one of the first things I did was I thought, All right, well, where are the numbers? I decided to pretend to be George Megalogenis for, you know, about 5 seconds until the ridiculousness of the Enterprise became apparent. I thought, well, where are the... I want to find out the comparative rates of wife having. Now, I should explain that when I say wife, you know, I use the term, you know, facetiously. I'm talking about... I define a wife as being a spouse who either works part-time in the paid workforce or not at all in the paid workforce, or works flexibly to the extent that they are able to kind of pick up things at home, look after the millions of things that make human households so fiendishly difficult to run, whether that's being at home for the plumber to arrive between the hours of 7 a.m. and 4 p.m., or, you know, complicated multiple drop-offs of children, or attending to ill elderly relatives or whatever, you know. And if you define a wife, as I do, in inverted commas, as a spouse who doesn't work or works part-time, I wanted to find what the comparative rate of wife-having was, you know, between men and women in Australia. I couldn't find the figures anywhere at all. And so with some expert help from the very smart Jennifer Baxter at the Institute of Family Studies, she had a comb through the census, which I'm sure George could have done in 20 seconds as well, but he was busy. I didn't want to disturb him.
You could have asked.
I know I could have, but, you know, you were...
I knew what the answer was 10 years ago.
Oh, sorry. Don't say that.
I shouldn't
now,
have said
George.
That. Now I'm joking.
Like,
of course, I knew that.
One of those room-sized home computers, you know. That's, you know. Anyway, so it turns out that of full-time working fathers, 76% of them have a spouse who is either full-time at home or works part-time. 76%. And of full-time working mothers, only 15% of them have the same arrangement. And we all, you know, love to have love in our lives, right? It's great to have a partner, or, you know, to be settled with somebody. It's even better than just the love, though. If you have a partner who works flexibly enough to pick up stuff at home that allows you to leave for work every day and devote yourself entirely to your work, you are an economic powerhouse, really. Having a spouse who operates like that is actually like quite a potent economic advantage, as well as being, you know, lovely. So I started thinking about, you know, that age-old question about, you know, what happens to women at work. And there's a huge amount of research and theory into why women don't progress to leadership positions in the same degree. I mean, the current shape of what a researcher that I read called Terence Fitzsimmons called the stupid curve goes like this, you know, something like 64% of university graduates are women. You know, women overtook men in terms of graduating from university several decades ago. That was taken care of in the 80s, so well done, ladies. And about women are about 45% of middle management positions, about 10% of executive positions, and then around about 2% of CEOs in the ASX 200, depending on, you know, whether Gail Kelly is on leave that week or not. So that's what happens, you know. These women sort of disappear as we get kind of to the more senior levels. And there are heaps of theories about that, mostly about what goes on at work, you know. And, you know, I say that there are two large groups of theories, broad groups of theories about why women don't sort of progress to the same levels in many workplaces. And, you know, I call them the men are awful school and the women are hopeless school. So the men are awful things are, you know, men don't promote women, they promote other men. Men have kind of, are often making the appointments, and they have a kind of a subterranean idea about who's more appropriate for this job, and that person normally has a willy. There's you know, structural disadvantages that are about sexual harassment and so on, men again, horrible, horrible. And then there's the women are hopeless school of arguments, which is all about how women don't lean in, or they wear too much cream, or not enough cream in the workplace, or they, you know, don't ask for jobs, or they don't ask for money, and they don't ask for anything. And there was this great book that I read called Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office. 101 ways that women sabotage themselves at work. And it's incredibly forensic and terrifying, and it legitimately has things like, don't wear your glasses on a chain around your neck. That is actually in there. Don't bake for your colleagues. You are not Martha Stewart. Don't have soft furnishings in your office. Don't leave trailing voice messages.
And God. How many of those did you tick off?
So I went through them, you know, in the spirit of frankness. And Lois P. Frankel, who is the woman who wrote this book, terrifies me to my bones because I feel I've failed her on every page. And I had made personally, I think, 66 of those 101 errors. And I thought, well, look, you know, really, this can't be all there is to it. And I think that sometimes, you know, look, the big thing that's changed, you know, in Australian society in the last half a century is women into the workplace. I mean, like, men haven't changed the way they work all that much, and they haven't really changed the way they function at home all that much either. Now, at this point, I should say, we all know honourable exceptions, and I'm aware that most of them are here tonight. Thank you, chaps. But, you know, I mean, the story of women in the last half century is of change. I mean, think about that whole public service marriage ban, right? 1966, that is not that long ago. You know, my mother-in-law was caught up in this piece of nonsense, you know, when she was giving birth to my delightful partner. So, look, you know, it's not all that long ago. And the big shift is from, you know, women in the home to women into part-time work. Like, that is the big shift. And yet, you know, we don't, when we talk about what happens to women at work, you know, we owe this huge amount, you know, to this galvanizing force of feminism that has made it, in the space of half a century, all of a sudden, not unusual for women to be in the workplace anymore, you know? It's not weird. People aren't freaks if they're female and at work, you know? Even if they're married, even if they have children, you know, but that change really hasn't been reflected on the male side of the ledger all that much. And if you have, as is the pattern, you know, this huge fleet of women who are now kind of juggling work and family and still doing much of the home stuff that they were doing, you know, a few decades ago, isn't it weird that men's patterns haven't changed that much? And I think when you look at what happens to women at work, you have to look at what happens at men to men at work as well. And I think you cannot have a productive discussion about the barriers that women face in the workplace until you also take account of the barriers that men face on their way out of the workplace. It's actually harder for men to leave the workplace and to sort of move in and out with the same flexibility that women commonly do when they have life events that dictate that they work differently. We still expect that women will change the way they work when they have children, for instance, but we don't automatically expect men to. And I think that seems like the next great frontier. And there are some pretty powerful kickbacks in that for women, I think.
So the question, when you look at the marriage bar, so the assumption now isn't woman has a baby, woman is sacked.
No.
But
although that does happen.
It can happen still, but the assumption is woman has a baby, must assume a step down, A, in career opportunity, and B, definitely in pay. So yep. that's sort of how Western economies have dealt with this particular
right.
structural shock. They've just dialed down the pay.
Well, one thing that is just endlessly fascinating to me, and I think it requires us to think very carefully about the assumptions that we make, because they are absolutely permeated through the patterns, you know, of work and family in this country, is that the simple act and the very common act of having a child means very different things for men from what it means for women in a professional sense. So there's this great kind of experiment. It's a US kind of social experiment where they, it's cited in the book, where this, I think it was Stanford, or I may be wrong, here's the first bit where I get a, I can't remember exactly where the experiment was carried out. But look, they drafted a whole bunch of undergraduates. You know, it was one of those great experiments where they lie to the participants about what it's about. I love those. I love the creative lying. Of course, you've got to fill out 1,000 forms explaining that no participant will be harmed psychologically. It's not like, you know, those horrible ones where they make people to pretend to be Nazis or anything. But they told this group of people that they were hiring, looking for a West Coast communications company, looking for a senior executive. And they gave each participant 2 CVs to look at. And sometimes they were 2 women and sometimes they were 2 men. And they were absolutely tested to be exactly equal in terms of weighted qualifications. But in one candidate, there was a subtle indicator that that person was a parent. So it would be like, you know, is an enthusiastic member of the PTA or something, whereas the non-parent would be picks up rubbish at the weekends, you know. And so what they did was they asked the participants to rate these applicants, you know, how appropriate are they for the job, how likely do you think this person would be to get promoted, what would be your average starting salary, you know. And what they found was that the women, between the women, the woman who was a parent was substantially behind her colleague in every respect, was thought to be less reliable, less promotable, less likely to be management material, and worth less money in terms of a starting salary. Whereas with the men, the guy who was a father was voted overwhelmingly management material, reliable, competent, and likely to be promoted. And his starting salary was well above either his childless male colleague or either of the chicks who were being evaluated by the other people. And it's interesting that the same biological event, having kids, having a family, means different things in terms of what people will expect from that person as an employee. And NATSEM in Australia have done this terrific back-of-the-envelope, brilliant calculation. It's not back-of-the-envelope, but of course it's completely reliable. And it looks at the earning prospects for an average 26-year-old employee in Australia today starting out on a 40-year career. And if you're a male 26-year-old employee starting out on an average career in Australia that will last 40 years, you can expect to earn $2 million over the course of that that career. If he has kids, that goes up to $2.5 million. If you're a woman, however, starting out on an average job for 40 years, you can expect to earn $1.9 million, but if you have children, that goes back to $1.3 million. So there is this real difference in terms of earning capacity once you figure family into the equation. It's still the case in this country that you are more employable, more promotable, thought more reliable if you are a man with children, and with women it works the other way.
This was one of the ones that I'm glad you've gone through these numbers and she's remembered them all perfectly. This was one of the bits of work that you've done that jumped off the page. And what I did, because I did a bit of a back of an envelope calculation.
George's are also highly reliable, mine less so.
No. So, 2 full-time workers, no kids, living together. He gets the 2, she gets the 1.9, that's 3.9. Dad gets the $500,000 pay rise. This is on average, right? Mm. He's at 2.5 and she's dialed down to 1.3. The 2 single people working full-time living together without kids are $100,000 off better over the long run than the traditional Australian household, dad working full-time, mum working part-time. If you want to know actually why these so-called working families whinge so much, it's that as a household unit, even though dad's got the pay rise, it doesn't compensate for mum's loss of earning potential, first point. Second point, and I'll get you to walk me through some of the research you found on how much work people do at home after a kid arrives, because that was, I haven't honestly had no idea how these things worked because I haven't done any work in this area. But you also dug out some American research about what happens as people's incomes rise, which was extraordinary. This is real XY chromosome, weird Venus and Mars kind of material we're about to enter into. But I'll get you to break it down, take it a step at a time, about how much work gets done at home after a kid
right,
arrives.
What you have to keep in mind throughout all of this, and this is what I kind of gradually came to realise over researching this book, is that, you know, we do, even though we're a really, you know, we like to think of ourselves as an egalitarian culture, we have really quite a robust attachment to the male breadwinner model. Much more so than America, for instance, you know. And part of that reason is we have a really high rate of part-time work and it's mostly women. So the way that we have changed is that men have stayed in full-time work, women have moved into the workforce, but they're in part-time work mainly, and they're juggling, you know. And the division of labour at home really hasn't changed all that much. And look, this is an international story. It's not just Australia. Australian women do quite a lot of housework, and Australian men do about half as much. And in the busiest families, which, you know, are families with kids, it's once children arrive, it starts to really go bonkers. Housework hours go up quite significantly. But the figures for a couple household with kids are, if the woman is not working in paid work, she'll do 65 hours a week on average housework. If she moves into part-time work, she'll drop that back to 52 hours. And if she moves into full-time work, these are all average figures from the ABS, if she moves into full-time work, she'll drop that back to 41 hours. And as she makes that change, her husband will pick up around about 34 minutes a week from
on your dad.
Yeah, yeah. But this is the weird thing about blokes, right? Women will change the amount of housework they do depending on, you know, whether they're not in paid work or if they're in paid work full time, you know. So you'll notice, those of you who can add up will notice that moving from, you know, not in the paid workforce at all to working full time, that lady dropped 24 hours of housework, like a full day of housework. And who picked it up? Well, her husband picked up 34 minutes of it, but, you know, the rest of it just sort of disappeared.
But she's working an extra 5 days.
The house is dirtier,
by the way.
Or, you know, there's more takeaway or something, you know. Anyway, but the husbands tend to work about 20 hours a week, roughly, and they work 20 hours a week whether they work part-time, full-time, or not at all in the paid workforce, or if their wife works full-time, part-time, or not at all. So there again, you have women kind of, you know, changing the way they work depending on, you know, what's going on, and men being really constant in their habits. And look, you know, there is so much to be said about, you know, and I discuss a lot in the book, you know, standards of work, what we consider to be appropriate degrees of cleanliness, because that is a really big issue. Like, it sounds flip to say that, but that is a serious issue. There's this great column, you know, written by a guy called Jonathan Chait for, I think, the Atlantic Monthly, where it's called, rather engagingly, The Case for Filth. And he describes the division of labour in his own home. And he says, look, we've talked about it and we've settled at a degree of cleanliness that is dirtier than my wife would like, but cleaner than I would, you know, keep things. And, you know, and it's quite important because, you see, this is why arguments about housework tend to be so upsetting, because they're asymmetric warfare, right? Quite often, you know, the actual net sum of housework, i.e. the minimum amount that is acceptable in any given week, is very different if you ask either party, you know, and that can be really upsetting when you have those arguments. But anyway, look, The weird piece of research that you talk about, and this is just, you know, bonkers. You know, I told you a minute ago about what happens when, you know, as women take on extra hours of housework. But there's another way of looking at this, and that is looking at what happens when women take on, you know, as their earnings increase. When you look at it by earnings, something totally strange happens. And it's actually an Australian phenomenon. Something different happens in America, but here's what happens in Australia. For every extra 1% of total household income a woman earns from a standing start of zero, she will do 17 fewer minutes of housework. And it's quite a graceful pattern. And this information comes from a study done by a woman called Janine Baxter, a Queensland academic who's really gone through this stuff. So 17 fewer minutes for every 1% of total household income. And that continues in a regular pattern right up until the point at which the woman earns 66.6% of the household total income, which is to say, you know, a good shade over half, which is to say she's become the primary breadwinner. What happens at that 66.6% mark, which I call the number of the laundress, is that she starts picking up housework again after that point. And that is completely bizarre, isn't it? And the theory that Janine Baxter has, and it's kind of the only way you can really explain it, is to attribute it to the strength of those underlying expectations in Australia about who will do what. Our expectation that in a heterosexual couple, the male will be the primary breadwinner is quite subterranean, but it's undeniably there. And the explanation for this weird behaviour is that if a woman violates one half of that expectation and out-earns her husband, she will compensate for it in other ways by picking up extra housework, by spending extra time in childcare. And, you know, I laughed at that research and then thought, hang on, actually, I reckon I've seen that in action. And I've done a whole chapter on called When Roles Are Reversed, which looks at, talks to women who are primary breadwinners, looks at some studies of female primary breadwinners, and also talks to a lot of men who have taken on primary caregiving roles, has a look at the sorts of puzzled reactions they get, even in this modern day and age, you know, men and women who tip up those expectations that we have about who will do what in the household. Interestingly, the American experience, and, you know, Janine Baxter went through this. I mean, you can imagine she's trying to figure out this pattern and just thinking, what the hell is going on here with these chicks, you know? And she's slicing it, dicing it, you know, what are the other factors that could, you know, controlling for all sorts of other elements, and she could not get rid of this pattern. In America, something different happens. As the woman becomes the primary breadwinner, her husband actually just drops off domestic work. She keeps up, you know, she doesn't pick up extra, but he drops it off, you know, in a kind of like weird protest move, I can only assume. But I mean, America is different because, you know, the skewing factor in America is that they have a really high degree of outsourced domestic labour, and a much higher degree of, you know, women in full-time work instead of part-time work. So that kind of skews things. You know, it's obviously interferes to have a social underclass that functions, you know, as a doer of other people's domestic labour. That's the difference with America and here.
In either case, obviously, the guy is suffering some sort of performance anxiety because he's been out-earned. Maybe in the Australian case, the woman is more forgiving and is anticipating his dropping off.
Well, she's compensating, you know.
She's certainly compensating.
Certainly.
I mean, he should get over it. But on average, he should get over it. But that's another thought.
But look, on the housework thing, you know, there is a really interesting thing going on in the private sphere as opposed to the professional work sphere. Like, I mean, like, it is now officially against the law to stand up, you know, in any busy workplace and say, do you know what? Women make really crap lawyers, or, you know, women can't count. Don't put them in charge of the books, or, you know, like, you would be up in front of Herioc if you said that, you know, in a workplace, because the workplace is regulated, right? And because it's not unusual to have women in a workplace. You can't say rude things about them, you know, and go unpunished, you know, in most workplaces, although there are cracks in the system, of course. But the home, you know, the domestic sphere is hilariously unregulated, right? And you can say anything you like. And it's perfectly acceptable still to stand up, you know, among a mixed polite crowd and say, my husband is rubbish at the whitewash. Or, like, I would never let my husband get the children dressed for school because they would go off wearing an eye patch and, you know, odd socks and it'd be a disaster. Or, like, oh, no, 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 no. I would never let my husband do that. I mean, you know, in New Idea, they still run a column called Mere Male, right? Which is where women hilariously write in recounting the domestic inadequacies of their husbands, right? That column started in 1950 and it's still going strong today. I bought a Best of Mere Male compendium, which was put out in the 80s. It's completely addictive reading because, you know, and it's sort of, you know, Amy of Glen Waverley writes in, you know, I went to my boyfriend's house for lunch and his mother cooked the lunch and pointed out that, you know, my boyfriend had made the salad. You know, darling, she squawked as she took her first bite of salad. Are you sure you washed the salad leaves? Yes, Mum. I even used soap. So, you know. And, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, it was almost a status symbol back then for your husband to be bad at housework because it showed how very excellent you were at it, you know? My household is run so tautly that my husband cannot boil an egg. That is because there is a round-the-clock supply of boiled eggs. He only need ask and I'll shimmy into my apron and, you know, make a soft-boiled, you know. It's kind of a status symbol. Just as, you know, in the 50s it was a status symbol for men to say, my wife doesn't work, nor need she. Right? But we've got over that stuff about, you know, it's a status symbol for my wife not to work, but we haven't necessarily got out of it being okay to assume that men are just shithouse at, you know, doing things around the house. It's really offensive, you know. And in our unregulated domestic sphere, we can blithely insult men as a gender without fear of retribution. And, you know, there's a whole segment of the advertising industry that absolutely depends on men being rubbish at, you know, nappies, for instance. I mean, nappies are the absolute nemesis of modern man if you listen to advertising. There's this great ad that ran in 2011, I think, in the States, and it was Huggies. They spent huge amounts of money filming this ad. It was like a Big Brother thing. They got the line of the ad was, To demonstrate just how tough Huggies are, we subjected them to their toughest test yet, dads. And they rented this house and kitted it out with cameras and they imported 10 dads with their babies and they made the dads look after the babies for a weekend and they filmed them. And they had, you know, like the game on and bowls of popcorn everywhere and beers and stuff. And then they cut this ad that was the dads all watching football while the kids wandered around with their, like, incredibly resilient nappies full of poo and, you know, it was just cats and dogs living together, you know, it's all wrong. And they ran this, I think, during the Super Bowl. And what was great was that there was this massive protest. People went berserk, like, including dads, you know, and wrote to Kimberly Clark and said, hey, you know, that's just offensive. And they took it off the air and they scrubbed it from the internet. Like, you cannot see that ad anymore. And they recut it in a matter of days and they put it back on air as to demonstrate how great Huggies are as a brand. We subjected them to the lovingest test ever. Dads at milk time. And they had all these gorgeous pictures of the dads feeding their babies with bottles and cuddling and burping them and, you know, even the full nappies after the bedtime bottle, you know, did not, I mean, was kind of weak as a premise for an ad, but, you know, it was an interesting.
They had spent the money.
Yeah, right.
They had spent the money. They had to put something out.
So yeah, it's a great demonstration of how you're. It's completely cool to insult a whole class of people and say that they're really bad at something. And what puzzles me is that if you, how can you expect, you know, men to be better at, you know, household stuff when there's a whole chorus of people telling them all the time, you're really crap at this? Or when men, and I talked to a whole bunch of men who were kind of primary carers and house husbands, as that lovely term goes, you know, turning up to play groups or mothers groups, you know, and at the school gate and kind of feeling like the freak at the circus. You know, maybe the same way that a woman moving into, you know, a law firm in 1956 might have felt, you know. It still kind of happens, and it shouldn't, you know. It shouldn't.
Without sort of killing your final theory, when do you think this thing might settle down? Or is it almost insolvable?
No, it's not unsolvable. I think you've just got to kind of stop assuming that things will be a certain way. I mean, you know, 50 years ago the assumption was that, you know, women's place wasn't necessarily at work. And now we don't, now we assume something different, right? So human beings can change, but you've got to have kind of an impetus for change, and you've got to challenge the assumptions that are there. And I think, you know, thanks to feminism, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about women at work, and there's a lot of information about what happens to women at work. But when you join it up with what happens at home, there are a whole lot of unanswered assumptions there about what men will do that we don't really spend time worrying about at all. Like, one of the great, you know, there's so little research that actually whacks it all together. And there's this great piece of research, this guy Terence Fitzsimmons, who talked about the stupid curve. So he's did a PhD at UQ. And it's a great PhD thesis because he actually sits down with 30 male CEOs and 30 female CEOs, and he asks them really nosy questions, not just the normal CEO questions, which are like, you know, how did your career track work, you know, did you have mentors, yada, 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 but like also really interesting stuff about their backgrounds, and like there's some really interesting just sort of alia in this sort of report that he did. For example, that of the 30 male CEOs that he interviewed, every single one of them had played football as a young man, and all but two of them had captained his team. Now, they almost all or all had children, and all but two of them had a stay-at-home wife, right? And they all cited, you know, being a family man as a really important part of their career, you know, trajectory. And they, you know, cited the support of their wives and so on. But the women were really different, you know, and they didn't have a unifying football experience at all. They came from kind of disparate backgrounds, but the pattern that he established, the men had all had, you know, stay-at-home mums and employed dads and really stable, you know, home lives. A lot of the women had had kind of unusual childhoods in some way, death of a parent, sickness, moving around, family breakup. And they seemed to have been moved early on into roles where they took on responsibility. You know, they kind of grew up early. And only two-thirds of them had children. And of those who had children, every single one of them described herself as the primary caregiver of those children, right? And only two of them had a stay-at-home spouse. So I think that's fascinating. I think you can't really understand the work thing and say, why is it that all these CEOs are men, you know, until you unpack all the rest of the stuff and say, well, what else is going on in your life? And I think to address those assumptions, you've got to look at the pattern of what happens to men and women, you know, in as a whole, not just what happens at work. And I think that we could do a lot more of looking at, you know, what happens to men at work and at home as well as what happens to women.
Now, we've got a couple of microphones. I was going to talk about a whole lot of other stuff as well. But
I think we've rabbited on.
No, you've done very well. We'll give the audience a shot. We'll be selling books later. I just want to plug the book again if I can, because Annabelle's done the courteous thing and not said, as I wrote in my book, which a lot of authors tend to do, but she doesn't. Not only is the research terrific, like she's had a look at she's asked every possible question. It's not just engagingly written. It's actually very thorough. And that's the first point, a point of recommendation. The other thing is that there's no offence to be taken in this book because you're actually approaching the question in a different way. There's a lot of tribalism and a lot of debates in Australia at the moment, and the work-family one is a, you know, the work-life balance, as the Americans call it, is probably the most tribal debate of all. It is a Venus and Mars kind of debate, but I never got this sense. I never know who you barrack for when I read you, and congratulate you on this book for pulling off one of the hardest things in this business, which is writing about this topic. So throw the questions. We can probably take questions on other things as well. I was going to ask about kitchen cabinet, but we'll leave that for another discussion. I'll let my mic people pick them out. This being Melbourne, of course, people like to give speeches. This isn't speech time, it's question time.
Kitchen Cabinet is coming back actually on the 21st of October, and we're starting off with Bob Hawke. You know, you've interviewed a little bit recently too. We've both spent time with Bob
recently. We've both spent time with Bob.
Did he cook you a fish?
Can I just say, can we scrub this bit? I do not broadcast this bit, right? So at the end of the Hawke interview, which sort of, I did one for a couple of hours with him, we went into the office for half a bottle of wine to kick our heels up. He didn't cook me anything. He just gave me a couple of glasses of wine at the end of it and said, let me just chew the fat. Anyway, question time.
You don't want that broadcast? Like, what happened then? Who took off their pants? Anyone?
No, we didn't have a camera rolling at the time, sadly.
Notice he didn't rule that out.
He didn't scull, by the way. He doesn't do that
no
anymore.
No one's asking a question because they want the answer to this, you know.
Far away, questions. He cooked for you, did he?
Hi, thank you. That was fantastic. And I love your description of dominant theories of why women don't do so well as men. Men are evil and women are hopeless. And I've heard descriptions that are much more complex but not as descriptive as that. So thank you. I just wanted to ask you about one point. You mentioned that men don't handle major life events as easily as women do. That, and I suppose I've read a lot of contrary research to that, that in fact one of the big factors that prevent women from moving up to senior levels is that women are more affected by issues like deaths or illnesses in families, and in fact that's a really major barrier, whereas men's careers, and I can't cite the reference, but are actually relatively unaffected by those kind
agree.
Of things.
So I totally agree.
Sorry, maybe I got
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. I think that men's careers... Look, if you have a look at, you know, I saw this great graph once, and, you know, if it was a graphy book, I would have put it in, you know. And it was a graph of, you know, sort of the average Australian man's, you know, professional life curve, you know. And it goes sort of up like this, teenage, whoop, up to full-time work, zzz, oh, retirement, you know. Like, it's kind of static. And the things that affect that working life are economics, you know. Men's working lives are affected by recession or, you know, being made redundant. It used to be war, right? But women's look like this. They kind of go, oh, teenage, we're up here. Whoa, oh, hammock here. You can actually see where children are or where, you know, other life events. Because I'm like, coping with a death in the family, let's say, is an emotional event, but it's also a practical event, you know. You need to do stuff. So who takes the time to do that stuff? Think about what happens in your families, you know. Who is the person that is going around attending to that stuff, you know? And I think that there is an assumption that that women will move in and out of the workforce a little bit, and so it's less kind of noticeable when they do it. It's less remarkable. When men do it, it's often seen as, you know, a bit of a surprise, you know, it's a bit remarkable. And I, you know, I think that's a very sad thing. If you have a look at, you know, part-time work, for instance, you know, 45% of mothers work part-time, but only 5% of fathers. And if you have a look at the change of fathers, you know, work patterns in the last couple of decades, well, 20 years ago, 87% of fathers were employed, and now it's 90%. So we see all this stuff all the time about, you know, the rise of the stay-at-home dads. And we get a lot of that stuff from America, by the way, because in America there really is a bit of a shift. And one of the reasons for that is that the global financial crisis really cleaned out a lot of jobs, and a lot of them were men's jobs. And so you have had this, you know, an economic event that has changed the way men work by just getting a lot of them out of their jobs, and now there are more households that are headed by women. Now, that in America is also confused by a higher rate of single-parent families as well. But, you know, that is an event that has changed things. And often, because there's so much, you know, newspaper coverage and media in America about this sort of new generation of stay-at-home dads, in Australia we kind of think, oh, it must be happening here. And Jenny Baxter, the researcher at the AIFS that I talked about, so she gets calls all the time from journalists saying, what about the, like, what are the stats on the stay-at-home dads? And actually it really isn't changing that much here. And while we all know, you know, people like men who work flexibly and stay-at-home dads, the pattern is overwhelmingly small. So if you had 100 average families in Australia, 60 of them would have, I'm talking about heterosexual families with children, right? So that obviously cuts out, you know, a lot of other families. But 60 of them would have a dad who works full-time and a mum who works part-time or not in the paid workforce at all. And only 3 of them would have a full-time working mum and a part-time or stay-at-home dad. And only 1 of them would have a full-time working mum and a stay-at-home dad. So that's what it looks like at the moment.
In relation to the research you looked at regarding attitudes to housework, the burden of housework, did you find any differences regarding different ethnic groups? Or was it predominantly a white Anglo-Saxon cohort?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. No, like the figures that I looked at were based on the time use surveys that, you know, were the sort of the lifeblood of statisticians in this country. They've actually, and the time use surveys in Australia have been referred to as the Rolls Royce. You know, they were actually dropped. The last phase of regular time use surveys were dropped during the Gillard government because they were too expensive. And so you have researchers weeping salty tears all around Australia because, you know, they did them every five years, I think. And, you know, we've now missed some. So it's really annoying because it's really useful data. And what that is families taking, like, diaries and actually filling out, you know, minute by minute what they're doing. And that's really interesting, these surveys, because sometimes, you know, our ideas of what constitutes housework differ. You know, like, if I'm watching the TV and my kids are playing with Lego, you know, that is formally childcare, but it's also something that I wouldn't necessarily be marking down as, you know, really kind of nourishing my brood, you know. So it's interesting, you know, time use diaries are always, always, always more reliable because people lie when they're asked by, you know, phone surveys are totally, well, they are less reliable because people tend to overestimate the work they do and they underestimate the work their spouse does. I think that this is a fairly universal phenomenon and one which I deeply understand. So that's why the diaries are useful. But no, I haven't looked at an ethnic breakdown. They may be available, but I was doing broad brush kind of gender-based patterns.
And a question at the back.
Yes, it's a huge question, but do you have any comments about the impact on parenting that should be kept in mind to rebalance?
Well, look, there's the funny thing about all of this is that it hasn't happened in a vacuum. You know, like this sort of men-women work tussle hasn't really happened in the last decades with the sort of parenting thing staying the same. Not at all. In fact, parenting has become more demanding. So, like, there's amazing research from the States indicating that a full-time working mother today spends more time in hands-on, you know, intensive parenting with her children than her stay-at-home mother did. And that's because parenting has become more intensive Our expectations of what constitutes adequate parenting have escalated. And our demands, you know, on parents are greater now, you know. And that's where I think, you know, men are in a bit of a bind because they're expected to be better fathers, you know, more hands-on, more intensive with their children than their fathers were. But they're also expected to work the same way, you know. Our base expectation at a kind of really deep subterranean level of men is that they will work the same way that they did, you know, decades ago. And I think that's strange. I just think perhaps a bit more open thought about how men might function differently would actually assist women to function differently as well.
We've got time for one more. We're just over 7:15, but we're almost at an end. But take one more question from the back.
Something that's come up a bit amongst single female friends of mine is a sense of unease that many of the single guys they know seem to have attitudes or assumptions about how their marriages will work one day that aren't really consistent with the female's dreams or aspirations or even what they might have to do to make ends meet. How do we address these issues as people who are engaged or dating or hoping to pursue a relationship that's productive and doesn't completely freak everybody out?
Well, that is really scary because, I mean, if you're not thinking about this stuff, and I mean, all the research indicates that, you know, a lot of these patterns really kick in when, you know, between men and women when they settle down and have children. And one of the reasons is that when you have a baby with someone for the first time, nobody knows what to do, right? Like there's this sort of shibboleth that, you know, women are better at babies or whatever. But I mean, speaking of my own experience, you know, when we had our first child, just everybody was useless at it, you know, for quite some time. And, you know, you acquire competence in these things just the same way as you acquire competence in anything else, practice. But the way that we work parental leave in this country basically stacks it so that women acquire competence really intensively early on. Norway, of course, Norway, has done something really interesting where a couple of decades ago they retooled their paid parental leave scheme because they've had one for decades. Thanks, Norway. You know, where they... it's a generous paid parental leave package and a big chunk of it is only available to the family if the dad takes it, right? So it's this sort of retooling of the idea of provider where, you know, your family will only get this money if you take some time at home. And their parental participation, you know, by fathers completely turned around when they introduced that. They have a really high rate of engagement of women in the workforce. They have a really healthy division of domestic labour as well. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about young people who are moving in that direction now, I think that, you know, the most important thing is to discuss it, right? Because if you just bowl along and think, well, we'll work it out when we get there. What happens is you join this vast pattern of what people already do and what people expect, which is not a neutral thing in this country at all. It's really quite geared towards a certain outcome. It's not insurmountable, not at all, you know. Just as it isn't insurmountable or impossible for men to work differently. Like lots of workplaces have flexible work policies that they kind of still direct towards women. I talked to lots of men in the book who decided they wanted to work flexibly and sort of saddled up and grabbed a copy of the workplace flexible working policy and sort of said, here's how I want to work. And quite often what happened to them is, you know, their supervisor said, well, that's not really for you, or, you know, tried to dissuade them in a sort of small way. And they kind of barreled on and they got there in the end, you know. It's a question of being determined and getting there in the end. But you may have to sort of ride through some assumptions, some kind of comments from co-workers, sometimes comments from family, you know. That's what happens when you do something that still in this country is seen as, on balance, you know, not quite the norm. But you get there in the end. And I think that, you know, the only way to really address that is by discussing it, particularly at that point where you're about to kind of get it all going on. Because if you don't talk about it, if you leave it, then after a while it kind of is entrenched and it's a bit too late.
I think we'd better leave it there because we are over time. Could I get you all to give Annabelle a round of applause?